We're recording now.
Good. All right, well, can everybody... welcome everybody to our special July 2016 SIO Story Lab call. And this one is with Elizabeth Ellis, a story wonder, an amazing woman who's given a pre-conference session today on authentic storytelling, saying what you mean, meaning what you say. And welcome, Elizabeth.
Thank you. Glad to be with you all.
Yeah. And Elizabeth, we're just going to have some questions. Everybody else at the table today is Sarah Armstrong, Mark Goldman, Cora Newcomb, Geraldine Sparrow, and me, Tom Sparrow. So we're going to have a conversation with Elizabeth and try to speak up so that you can hear. Is there an opening question that somebody has for Elizabeth?
I could start with a story.
A story's always a good place to start. Maybe I'll tell the one I told this morning to kick us off. Would that work?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Excellent.
Well, this is an adapted folk tale, and I use adapted loosely. One time back up in the mountains, there lived a woman. She was called the Widow Baker. She'd been a widow for a while. And because she's a widow, she needed some way to help her make a little extra money, to make a buckle meet the tongue, as people used to say. And so she did some weaving. And she sold the weaving to her neighbors. She had the reputation for being the finest cook in the whole area. In fact, whenever she made...
Hi, it's Jules.
Good. Hi, Jules. Elizabeth is telling us a story right now, so welcome and listen in.
Okay, great.
Whenever Widow Brown made something, people would line up at a church picnic to get a piece of it or get some of her potato salad. Mm-mm, that was really a treat. For the weaving, she kept some sheep, and I have to tell you, we had a lot in common, she and I. We live in gated communities. I grew up in a gated community. If you didn't close the gate, the cows would get out. And in her case, it was the sheep that got out. She never did figure out who had left the gate open. Nobody would own up to it. But the sheep were missing, every single one of them. And she went down the road looking for her sheep. And she went right past Old Man Wilson's place. Now, Old Man Wilson, he had the reputation for being the finest farmer in the area. Grew the most magnificent vegetables you ever laid your eyes on. And he was an old man, but he was still strong and hearty. And he was pretty proud of the work that he could do. He'd been plowing all morning. And so when she came by and she asked him about her sheep, he was hard of hearing, and he didn't really understand what she said at all. He thought that she was asking him about the plowing, and so he pointed to it very proudly. And all she noticed was the direction in which he was pointing. She thought that he was telling her which way the sheep had gone. And she told him that when she found her sheep, she would bring him a reward. So she went over the brow of the hill, and right down there on over the crest of the next hill, she found all of her sheep. But one of those sheep, a little lamb, it had a wounded leg. It looked like maybe a dog had bitten it or something. And she was really upset about that. She was carrying that lamb home, and she was herding all the sheep in front of her as she came back up the road. And as she came back up the road, she was thinking, well, that old man, he has the reputation for being a very kind person. I'll give him this little lamb as a reward because he doesn't have any other sheep. It will be all by himself, and he'll take care of it and nurse it back to health. If I take it to my place with all my other sheep, it's likely to get hurt worse. One of the other sheep might step on it or lay down on it, or the little fellow would fare better if he was at old Farmer Wilson's place. So she came up the road. She stopped in front of Farmer Wilson's place, and she called out to him. He was sitting on the porch. when he heard her and saw her, he went out there to see what she was saying, because being hard of hearing, he couldn't hear what she said from the road, and he really couldn't hear her from close up either, to tell the honest truth. So she handed him this little sheep, the little lamb, and he saw that the leg was wounded. He thought she was accusing him of having hurt her lamb. And he said, "No, I didn't do this. I would never do a thing like this. I've never hurt an animal in my entire life." Well, all she heard was "no." And she said, "Well, this is a very good reward. You should be willing to accept this reward. It doesn't matter that it's a lamb instead of a full-grown sheep. This is very good. All you did was point the way the animals went." He kept yelling, "No, no, no, I never hurt an animal in my whole life." The only part he could understand was "no." And every time he said it, it just made her madder. And she kept saying, "Well, you're a pretty greedy person to be expecting a whole sheep in exchange for just lifting your arm and pointing the direction down the road." They got to arguing. They were saying the most foolish things to one another you ever heard in your life, yelling at one another at the top of their lungs. And finally, a deputy sheriff driving by heard all that racket and stopped. He arrested the two of them and threw them in the back of the squad car because he couldn't get them to calm down or stop yelling. He took them into town to the courthouse and took them right up before the judge. Now, the judge was a really old man. Old man. And since he was such an old man, he was so hard of hearing that he had a reputation for being the finest judge in the whole area that they had ever had. And you may wonder why he would have a reputation for being a fine judge and what that had to do with not being able to hear, but I'll tell you. The reason that helped him be a really fine judge was he could not hear the enormous lies that people told on the witness stand. And he also couldn't hear the lawyers. And since he couldn't hear the lawyers and all the foolishness that they came up with, not being able to hear was a big advantage. It made him a very fair judge. And since he was old, he couldn't see very well either. And since he couldn't see very well, that made him an even fairer judge. He couldn't see the people who came to court and whether or not they came in their old bib overalls straight from the farm or if they came in some big fancy three-piece suit. So that was a good thing that he couldn't see and he couldn't hear. And he kept looking out at those people in front of him, and after a long time, he studied out it was a man and a woman. And it looked to him like the woman had something in her arms that was wiggling and trying to get down. He'd been a judge for so long that he knew that one of the chief reasons a man and a woman would come to court is because they wanted a divorce. And he thought that maybe that thing that was wiggling and trying to get down was a child, and the two of them were arguing about which one of them would get to keep the child and raise it. And so he said to them, "How long have you been married?" But the only part that the Widow Baker understood was "how." And she thought that he was asking her about how many sheep she had. And she said, "About 30, Your Honor." Well, he heard that. He said, "30? You have been married for 30 years and you haven't figured out a way to live together in peace and happiness? You ought to be ashamed of yourselves. Now, I want you to go straight home and be living in peace and quiet and harmony together as husband and wife and make a good home for that young one there. And if you don't do that, I'm going to throw you both in jail." And then he left the courtroom. Well, the deputy sheriff had to explain to the old couple what the judge had said because they didn't understand it at all. And when the Widow Baker heard about it, she said, "Well, we're not married." He says, "Well, you have to get married. You have to get married right away." He said, "If you can live together in peace and quiet as husband and wife, he's going to throw you both in jail." And so on the way out of town, the two of them stopped at the preacher's house and they got married. And since she was the best cook in the whole area and he grew the very best vegetables in the whole area, since neither one of them could understand a word the other one said, they lived happily ever after.
That's so good.
My addendum to that story is how little we are willing to listen. There's a lot of different ways to be deaf. Some is deafness that's physical and can't be helped, But a lot of our deafness, a lot of our deafness is really founded in not being willing to hear what's happening around us. And sometimes in not wanting to know. I wonder how our families would change, how our neighborhoods and communities might change, how our nation might change if we made a commitment to trying to listen to other people in a different way than we have in the past.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
Yes.
Cora, you have a question?
Well, it seems to me to not only absolutely that if we listened better, the world would be a better place. You know, but it also seems to me that the story is such a good illustration of what happens in organizations. People
yes.
hear what they
want to hear. Exactly.
And then the rumors begin. And I know the organizations that I have lived, that I've worked in, you know, the rumors, people believe them.
Right.
And so then that changes the dynamics in that organization, and, you know, backpedaling is so hard to do.
Right. One of the things that we can absolutely know is that there is going to be story and it is going to be told. The only thing that we can do is try to help people be properly informed so that at least some of the people are telling a story that bears some resemblance to what really is happening. The rumor mill is utterly amazing. But, you know, last year at this conference, we had Kendall Haven do a keynote. If you haven't looked at Kendall Haven's book called Story Proof, go to Amazon or one of those places. Go to Blue Ridge Books and support somebody from Appalachia if you'd like. But order a copy of Story Proof and read that book. There's a whole lot of value in what's in there. And one of the things he talks about is how our human minds are built to take unrelated things and connect them together. He gave us examples of three sentences that had nothing to do with one another. And by the time he finished the third sentence, we had all invented a story in our minds that explained all three sentences and the context in which it would have happened. It was stunning to us to see how we were absolutely gobsmacked to see how we had done it. But we had, every one of us had done it. We had taken A, B, and C and invented a whole alphabet around A, B, and C. We invented an entire story, and it wasn't because we were storytellers. All human beings do that. That's how our brain works. A part of it being because we are intelligent animals who need information, and if we are not given information, then we take what little shards we have and try to weave it into some pattern that makes some sense to us. But the story we tell may be totally, totally different than the real facts of what actually happened. Or our interpretation of it may be totally different than what really was going on.
And just a little aside, on our Story Lab page on our website, we've had Kendall be one of our Story Lab speakers. And so you can also just download that right on our website, storytellingandorganization.com.
Fabulous. It's a great idea. He's so smart. He's one of those people I think of as being scary smart.
So, Elizabeth, how would you deal with an organization where that happens, where the rumors run rampant or the people have only bits and pieces of information? How do you help them change into finding, getting, and telling the correct stories versus the incorrect ones?
You have to convince the people in charge about the importance of transparency. We talked this morning about how there is no such thing as privacy anymore. No matter what's happened, you can absolutely know that people will find out about it. The only thing question would be is how long is that going to take?
And what version?
And what version, right. We need to, when we work with other people, agencies, organizations, businesses, we have to convince the people in charge that they need a free flow of honest, authentic information. And that's kind of hard to do sometimes. But that free flow of information creates a climate that's healthier and really more business-oriented in the long run. Because all the energy that people have been using on conjecture can be put into productivity. A person who's busy trying to weave little pieces of information together to make them make sense doesn't have time to do their work. They're busy trying to make sense out of what they've been told, what little bit they've been told. I once worked for a fine man, and one day I came to the library, and he was not there. And the director of the library was there in his place and told us that he was gone. He had gone away, and why was none of our business. Something awful happened. Something happened that had gotten him arrested. But the fact that they told us it was none of our business when we had been his beloved colleagues for many years absolutely infuriated us. And I can tell you for a slick fact that absolutely not one lick of work got done in that library for maybe 6 months, maybe longer than that, because all we could talk about was the fact that they didn't tell us what happened. They treated us like children. They didn't even give us any... I mean, it makes me angry to think about it, and it was more than 40 years ago. Okay? And it was the lack of information that we were given that made me... And the dismissive treatment that we received at the hands of the administration that upset me so badly that it makes me want to chew a hole in the tablecloth right now, even though it was more than 40 years ago. Telling people the honest truth is always the way to go. Transparency is always the way to go. People are going to find out. Whatever it is you're trying to hide, people are going to uncover it. We are people with inquiring minds. And boy, howdy, we will run down every detail, you know. And we will put into that the absolutely worst possible,
interpretation.
The absolutely worst interpretation that we can cut, not that we're trying hard to do that, but because it is the way our minds work. Not given information, we invent information. Not given story, we invent story. To make sense out of, one of the things that story does is make sense out of our world. Mm-hmm. So if our world isn't making sense and you don't give us facts, we will invent facts to make our world make sense. It is the way our human brains are wired. So giving people authentic flow of information all the time is the only way to be successful in an agency, an organization, a business, a family, a neighborhood, no matter who you are, no matter what's going on.
So you come to an organization that has all of this going on, the rumors, the distrust, the lack of information, the dismissing of employees. And so you want to go in there and work with them? I mean, certainly you're not going to go in there and lecture the president of the corporation. So
No, you're not going to lecture because lecture's not going to be successful.
Understand. I mean, absolutely, I understand that.
But you're going to show. You're going to tell them some stories about places that have overcome the challenges that they are having. That people have handled, the stories of people who have handled the situation in a different way, and hope that they're smart enough to make an extrapolation out of that about what could be useful to them.
Talk a little bit, Elizabeth, about authenticity and how an organization truly is authentic and what the people are like if their authentic workforce, authentic management.
Well, gosh, that's sort of hard to describe. It's kind of like pornography. I know it when I see it. Usually, it needs to come from the top down. Usually, it means leaders who understand the value of being honest with people and having high integrity. And it filters down from there. If you work for someone that you believe expects that of you, you're going to come up with it. And they're going to, in turn, expect it of the people who are under them and on down the line. If you work for someone who is deceitful and whose first response to everything is want to tell a lie about it and cover it up, that's going to filter down as well. And our culture is filled with people who do that all the time.
Let's just say that you happen to work for a company that is like that, that is filled with people who are dishonest. Can one still stay authentic themselves without leaving? Is there a middle ground? You know, of course, if you find yourself in that situation, you might say, I'm getting out of here. This is just the wrong environment. But some people don't have that option, because they need the job, they have to have their income, they can't find another job, and so they try some way to find...
to reconcile the situation. Yeah. I'd say if you were in that situation that, number one, you want to take a course in writing resumes. But...
or hire Elizabeth Ellis.
There are some situations... not nearly as many as you'd think, but there are some situations where you need to stay where you are for one reason or another. Mostly, deciding you have to stay there is not looking at all the options and being willing to live with a certain amount of deceit. If you are not willing to do that, then perhaps the first thing you need to do is try to figure out how honest you can be in the situation you find yourself. How much of the truth can you tell? How much can you get away with? Gandhi said, be the change you want to see in the world. Well, in whatever situation you find yourself, you can do as much as you can do. You know, if your boss is telling you, if you say that to anyone, I'm going to fire you, then... maybe you'll need to back off from that. But if nobody's saying that to you, or they're not saying it that straightforwardly, you could push the envelope. Begin pushing the envelope and see exactly how much of the truth you can get away with telling. We all want to be, I'm assuming, people who have high integrity. And the only way to be that is to be it, and to be it in every situation in which you find yourself. And not be people who are not willing to speak the truth. Sometimes we have to say things like, you know, what you were saying makes me uncomfortable. Sometimes we need to say things like, I doubt your facts. Can you show me where those facts come from? Because that doesn't match my experience. I would really like to... help me here. Help me here. Sometimes we can say things like, well, I know in the past we have often done it this way, but I'm not thinking it worked very well for us. What if we try another approach? What if we just gave people the information and helped people process it and stood behind what we said? I think people are drawn to honesty. They're drawn to integrity like a moth to a flame. There is a guy in Dallas whose name is Paul, and Paul is a mechanic. And a few years back, I brought my car into Paul. The entire car was shaking like a leaf. I thought my entire front end had gone out, and I could hear the cash register ring in the back of my mind. And Paul said, well, let me look at it, and he put it up on the lift. And after he looked at it, he said, that tire's out of round. Why don't you go down the road there to Jerry Lee's Used Tires and get Jerry to sell you a good used tire to replace that one. It's out of round. Now tell Jerry that I said you weren't going to pay more than $20 for a tire. I did exactly what he said. I thought I needed to spend maybe $400, $500 on the repairs of the front end of my car, and I ended up spending $20 for a tire. Guess who is my mechanic and has been at this point for more than 40 years? And because he is as honest as the day is long and has the highest integrity of any mechanic I've ever dealt with, my daughter goes to him, my son-in-law goes to him, my son goes to him, my daughter-in-law goes to him, my grandson drives his car from Houston to Dallas, 270 miles, to get Paul to work on it. Because who would go to one of those guys in Houston that you don't know? You know that Paul is always going to tell you the truth. And he'll tell you, now this is wrong, but it would last you another 6 months. But this got to be fixed right away before I let you pull out of the driveway. Because he runs his business that way, my intern and my intern's wife, their two children, their in-laws, the people that they are married to, the parents of the people they are married to, drive into Dallas so Paul can work on their cars. There are probably easily 40 people who have Paul do everything that has to do with their cars because he told me that tire's out of round. Which is better business practice? Oh, yes, ma'am, it needs a new front end. That's going to cost you about $485. Take me about 2 weeks to get it back to you. Or a new tire would fix that. And if you don't have the money for a new tire, a used one would do just as well. $20 is going to take care of it. He has made thousands of dollars in 40 years' time. Thousands of dollars, big old bass boat, really nice home in the country, horses, pedigreed dogs, takes his wife to Hawaii on vacation because he said that tire's out of round.
Yeah.
And I don't understand why business people and agency people and organizational people and politicians and school board members and all that don't understand how it works. I don't understand why it's such a huge mystery, because it's so simple. Remember what your mama taught you when you were little? Yeah.
And let's open it up to questions from our callers. Anybody have a question on the other end of the line there? Once you're unmuted.
Well, I have a question. I had dealings with an organization that had been really great, and then the top management changed, and it started a downhill slide.
Ooh.
And the question that people had was, do I wait out this management to change again because I like being here, or is it time to get out?
That's a hard one. That's a question people can only answer for themselves. How much are you willing to jeopardize your integrity?
Yeah.
Before you say, I'm going to tie these two sheets together and see if I can get over the wall. Yeah. Everybody's got, I guess, maybe everybody's got a place where they go, I can't do this anymore. Yeah, but it's different for every person.
But would it be an opportunity, since you've worked with organizations, to go in there and propose a retreat to help the transition?
Well, in the spirit of transparency, I worked there, and I eventually bailed because I could not maintain my integrity. But I worked there for a long time, and I was accused of not being genuine by people. And I said, because you don't understand what my motivation is.
Right.
And once I would say that, then they would let off. But it was...
They'd start to think about it from your point of view.
Yeah, yeah, that there was a reason why people might stick around.
The story always sounds different from other people's points of view. Mm-hmm. Yeah. My favorite story about that is James Foreman, the boxer. When I heard that James Foreman, the boxer, had three sons and all of them were named James Foreman, I thought, that man must be the most arrogant person who ever drew
Foreman.
Breath.
Yeah, George Foreman.
I'm sorry,
yeah,
George Foreman. George not Foreman. James Foreman was the head of CORE back in the 60s. Yeah. Pardon me. George Foreman had three sons and their names all George Foreman. Mm-hmm. I thought, man, he is so full of himself. How can he stand to get up in the morning? And then I heard him one late night on the Arsenio Hall show years ago, being interviewed by Arsenio, and Arsenio said what nobody else had ever asked him before. So, George, you have three sons and they're all named George. What's that all about? George Foreman said, my mama couldn't tell me what my daddy's name was. So when my son was born, I wanted everybody to know that he was my child and that I was proud of him and that I wanted him to know that he was important enough to me for me to give him my name. And when the next one was born, I didn't feel any different. Or the third one either. And, well, my daughter, her name is Georgiana or Georgie, and I don't remember which one it was. But I remember thinking, I have so misjudged this human being. Yeah, knowing his side of the story was very moving to me. What we were looking at was the healing, the attempt to heal a very old lifelong wound.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I had seen it as being supreme arrogance, you know. I'm so full of myself. Yeah. You know, other people's stories that you begin to see things way differently. Have you thought up any questions out there? Well, the answer then is yes.
And 42.
But sometimes no. And occasionally, maybe.
Oh, yeah.
This is Mark Young.
Mark, how you doing?
I'm doing well. How about you, Elizabeth?
You feeling better?
Yeah.
All right. I'm stronger. Me too.
Part of where what you're saying draws my mind is I'm in the organization that I'm in right now is going through a major reorganization and reshuffling and people getting reassigned, and there's just a huge shakeup going on, and I may have been around the block a few more times than is good for me, but I'm not convinced it's going to have any really useful outcome other than to disrupt people's lives. So there's a consultant, a former professor at George Washington University named Jerry Harvey, and he made brilliant use of stories in a lot of his articles and books that he wrote. Wrote something called The Abilene Heron, you may have heard, but he wrote one called Eichmann in the Organization. He questioned the willingness of human resource departments to carry out assignments, things kind of like this reorganization we're experiencing here, where it really makes you question what's meant by the copy of this article I commended the organization with our office director. Just said something you might find interesting reading as we head into this rework. And I got back a very nice thank you note that basically commended the article to the attention of other managers in the organization so that they could come up with better strategies for going right ahead with what they were going to do anyway, but you know, find better tactics for selling the idea, which is not quite what I had in mind. So I'm just wondering what more effective use of storytelling I might have applied to that situation to get the point across, because it doesn't feel like it had the impact I'd hoped it might.
Jeepers.
I'd like to speak to that. It's Jules here, Julian Ryan, and I came out of that world for the latter part of my work with HR, but for a good couple of years I was doing a lot of employee relations, and unfortunately at different parts the reorganizations are out letting people go for assorted reasons. And I agree with your point. Sometimes it is treated like a commodity, and I think one of the things you can help people is to teach them the story of the person who's sitting in the seat that is watching this and witnessing these events, because a lot of times we're like, we're going to retain our best people. And that best person walks out the door, or that person who felt respected and understood it from a cognitive point of view up to that point, they've lost face or they weren't treated kindly. I had one of my ex-staffers just got let go. There was an organizational change in the company we both came out of. And, you know, they shut everything down after 18 years. So it's like, you can use that analogy of a story, too, and say, what story do you want people to tell when they come back to work the next day, like what was discussed earlier? That's all anyone will talk about. They won't talk about what you did well. They'll talk about the idiotic things that happened and how people lost face. So you might have not seen the result, but if you can make a little change in somebody's mindset and how they handle it, you'll make a big difference. And and you'd be surprised sometimes. Maybe there was some positive to what came out of your article. The fact that they got some courage to share it was a positive step. Maybe not what you wanted them to do, but they did take some action. And maybe you hit a nerve there when you shared that article.
Well, I can certainly hope so. Thank you for that.
In some situations like that, it's hard to know what you could do that would make much difference, make much change. I keep thinking there is something, we just don't know what it is.
I like what you said, but again, Jules, it's as much as, in having lived through a lot of scenarios, it's as much as what we say as what we don't say. I think what really gets people's backs off, too, is when they're pandered and they're given some trite phrases. And it also, if they haven't had a relationship with the person who's going, you know, like, there's so many things that happen in organization, but if it feels authentic, not just from the words out of their mouth, but what's coming out, and it just, I've seen the good, bad, the ugly, and how things get handled, and sometimes the simplest things that I thought, oh, that made absolutely no difference, you know, me showing up and just being quiet, sometimes was the best thing I could have done, just shut up and listen, and sit there and just respect the situation. So I think some good points were made, because unfortunately we do treat our workplaces like commodity exchanges. We're going to trade off the box on one shelf, it's on the shelf, and trade in a new box in a particular area. So it's unfortunate.
Yeah, it's true.
It's hard to know sometimes when and how to go all in. I'm reminded of around the time that Albert Speer published his memoir, Inside the Third Reich, Woody Allen wrote a piece for The New Yorker, and it was called I Was Hitler's Barber. And he gave all of these incidents of his recollections as Hitler's barber when he gave him really trivial advice and comments in the course of cutting his hair, which later showed up in things like the decision to invade the Soviet Union and the very last throwaway paragraph was as for the Holocaust and the concentration camps and all of that. I didn't know anything about it until very late in the war, and by that time it was too late to speak up because I'd already made a down payment on the new dining room set.
Yeah. You know, maybe we could finish up our conversation, Elizabeth. You told us a story about your favorite little short story, because we've kind of been talking about situations that we get ourselves into and when do we let go and when do we not.
And what it's like dealing with change of any kind. It's a very short story, so you have to listen fast. There was a man who lived in hell. He could leave any time he wanted to, but he never did, and that was because he knew the names of all the streets. It's an awfully powerful story, especially for being so short.
Yeah.
Many of us stay in hell for a very long time because we know the streets and have the bus schedules.
And have our own cubicle.
Right, have our own cubicle in hell.
Yeah. And organizations stay doing the same thing they do because that's what they've done.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They write the street map.
Write the street map. That's a great line. I love that. That's a great line.
So you go into the organization with this new map, and you hang it on the wall and say, let's talk about this map. This new map.
Any closing comments?
Well,
it's Jill. Sorry, just want to jump in with a compliment and just like a synapse merge that just happened. I love the story that was told earlier because to me it's such a it could really counter and complement what we do with our texts, our emails, our spoken conversations, and the rumor mill of all those other five senses and pair things that happen and how people reached us. So I think that's such an excellent story to drive a point home about what people see and hear, sometimes through a one-line, Facebook message and stuff.
A year or so ago, I went to visit my old friend, and they are caretaking a piece of property that belongs to very wealthy people. And I observed that the husband would stand in the doorway and call across the living room to his wife and ask her a question, and that she would answer, and that her answer had nothing to do with the question that had been asked. And that when she answered, he would say, oh, okay, good, I'm glad we agree. And he would go out and do whatever it was that that neither one of them could hear it thunder anymore, but neither one of them would admit it at all. And so they have all these long conversations about whether or not the carpet should be taken up or whether or not the wallpaper should be replaced in the kitchen and everything. And they really thought they were talking to one another, but they were not at all.
Yeah.
And it reminded me of so many organizations where I've worked over the years, either worked in them or worked with them, where the people are talking, but they don't hear one another. They don't understand what's happening. The information that's given doesn't match the question asked, and vice versa, So, yeah, it was funny, but it wasn't funny. This is a time of great distrust. We played a game this morning called Who Do You Trust? And I asked people to stand as I read off a recited a long list of agencies and organizations. And it was really interesting to see how much distrust there is. People don't trust the government, political organizations, humanitarian efforts, the church, their local government. I mean, a list as long as my arm. The level of distrust is just so widespread that we have to try everything we can to be of scrupulous integrity in our dealings with other people to try to restore any kind of trust here in the United States. Every time people see trust, it gives them hope. They see anything that they think is deserving of trust, it gives them hope. And hope is the opposite of despair. As people slip into despair, they become completely paralyzed and cannot do anything, or cannot accomplish anything. So all of us need to be looking for, remembering, telling stories about anything that gives people hope. It's a way to help our country. Think of it as being a new way of being patriotic, of being of service. Thank you all for calling in.
Oh, thank you. Oh, great.
Thank you.
Patricia, thank you so much.
Thanks.
I'm just blown away by how much I got from this call. So.
Hi, Tricia.
Hi, Trish.
Great. Well, thank you, everybody, and have a great rest of your day. And over and out here from the National Storytelling Network Conference in Kansas City, where the people are going crazy.
Hey! Woo!